welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a wonderful weekend. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thank you so much for joining us today. Coming up in just a bit, celebrating North Dakota's writers and artists, a free day-long celebration bringing local and regional writers, artists, and audiences is being planned for September 26th at the University of Jamestown. The festival features opportunities to meet creators, purchase their work, and explore creative processes through free workshops, and we'll look forward to that conversation. But first, a plaque for peace. Important today, honoring the U.S.-Canada bond. For nearly a century, the International Peace Garden has stood as a symbol of the enduring friendship between the United States and Canada. On September 12th of this year, members of the Daughters of the American Revolution from North Dakota and Canada will gather there to dedicate an American 250 marker. The ceremony will recognize the men and women who contributed to American independence, while also celebrating the long and peaceful relationship shared by two neighboring countries. The event is the result of international cooperation between Daughters of American Revolution members on both sides of the border. Joining us are Helen Hatton of the Upper Canada DAR and Sandy Sidler, North Dakota's State Chair of the DAR's America 250 Committee. Helen and Sandy, to both of you, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Sandy, if I could, I'd like to begin with you. Begin by telling us about the marker that will be dedicated at the International Peace Garden. What does it commemorate?
So this is an America 250 Patriot marker, and it commemorates the, like you said, men and women who participated in the American Revolution 250 years ago and supported the American Patriots. These include Patriots on both sides of the border, mostly in Canada, in the Quebec area, because that's where the population was at the time. And then also patriots who were on the American side, obviously in the 13 colonies. And since that time, their descendants have moved all across both countries. And so we have DAR chapters in many places, including Canada and Australia.
And I'm going to continue with Sandy for just a second. We have chapters all over the world.
Sure.
There are 24 chapters around the world, including two Air Force base or two military bases, one in Guam and one in Ramstein, Germany, but Japan and all over Europe, Australia, as Sandy said, and of course, four in Canada.
What are the Daughters of the American Revolution?
Well, Sandy described it perfectly. All of us who are members, and this can be anybody who can trace their ancestor back to an ancestor who supported George Washington and the troops. And that was a whole lot of people, because certainly in New England and Quebec, as Sandy was saying, families split up during the Revolutionary War. They, half of them in New England, a lot just packed up and went up to Canada to support the king. The rest of them stayed. And then, as America grew and expanded, we've got descendants all over the world. There's a luscious one about Australia. An officer who served with George Washington emigrated to Australia in the 1700s and had four daughters. Bingo. So that's one race that they have spread all around.
If I may, the Daughters of the American Revolution is a nonprofit, non-political organization. And we're based on the direct lineage, as we said, back to the Revolutionary War. We are a service organization primarily. We provide service to our community and to the state and to the nation through three main mission areas: historic preservation, education, and patriotism. So those are our main areas that we focus on.
On September 12th, this marker will be dedicated at the International Peace Garden. What's the historical significance of the words and the images that are included on the marker? Describe it for me, if you would.
Well, the marker basically says a Revolutionary War patriots. And so we're commemorating their service across the country. And like you said, There are a lot of these markers going up. The goal was to have one marker in every state, and we have an additional marker in North Dakota that we placed at Bonanzaville in Fargo a couple of years ago. This is an ongoing event, obviously. It's been going on for several years. It will continue to go on. As most people don't realize, the war actually lasted 8 years. Therefore, this commemoration is lasting that long. So just because this year is the actual anniversary of America 250, we are not done. We are still celebrating.
Helen, you live in Canada. How did you become involved in this particular project?
I couldn't resist. We're what is quaintly named as the units overseas, which chapters that is offshore from the lower 48, was really begun in the late 1800s, and they've spread. And we have these chapters here, four in Canada, as I mentioned. And this is just a side bit, but my friend in British Columbia, who is also coming to the event, and I were chatting, and I said, Barbara, let's go to North Dakota. She said, okay. And I said, there's the new presidential library that's just opened up. I want to see it. So we're planning a trip around North Dakota because we wanted to come to the only international event that the DARs are having, and that's with the four Canadian chapters. And also it's a chance to get out and see the country and see something we've never seen before and meet new people. And, you know, the really nice thing is that right now it's a pretty hot time with politics, which we don't get into, but it's also really good to deal with people at a level like this. We're all still friends. We have to remind each other that this is on this level, we're friends with these people. We have a common denominator. We have history. We have everything else. And so what if the rest of it's going to hell? But here at this level with people and the environment and seeing it and seeing the country is just really overrode everything else.
Sandy, tell me what will happen on the 12th. How will the event take place?
Basically, what will happen is most of us will come in the night before, and we're staying at the casino, which is the closest place nearby. We'll probably gather Friday night just to meet each other and talk.
Definitely.
Then Saturday morning, we'll head to the Peace Garden to set up everything so we'll be ready for the event. We're planning on the dedication starting at noon on Saturday. We will have a dedication. We'll have an unveiling of the plaque. We'll have a couple of short speeches, just some information on the Canadian history and the American history, and, you know, mention a few actual patriots that participated so people have a feeling for that. And then we will have some light refreshments in order to gather and to talk and to enjoy each other's company some more. So it'll be a very relaxed event.
Helen, what are you looking forward to making the trek here? Is it a meaningful trip coming to do something like this?
It is. And that's what sparked the rest of, I want to see more of North Dakota. I want to see just to get out, but it's also to meet our sisters in North Dakota and get to know them. That's what I find absolutely great about the DAR. When we have a big meeting in Washington, D.C. every year, somebody referred to it as the world's largest sleepover. And it's true. It's a lot of absolutely dynamic, marvelous women from all over the world who get together, and we have a common denominator, which almost is by the side. But the point is that we're all brought together and we visit, and the strength that's there behind these meetings is huge. And you go away with a wonderful feeling, a very positive feeling about, you know, things may just be okay.
Just to go back and give you a little history of how we developed this project. One of our members in North Dakota, who's very active, her name's Nancy Ligursky, she suggested that we place a marker at the Peace Garden, and she contacted the Peace Garden to see if they would be willing to put a marker there, since they have a lot of different markers there, including a 9/11 memorial at the Peace Garden. So this is very, it's a unique place as far as that goes. So she contacted them. They were interested in allowing us to place a marker at their location. At that point, I started getting involved because I am the chair of the committee, and working with Nancy, we developed this plan that because the DAR National was providing grants to help pay for these markers, we thought, well, we will apply for these grants. And the way it worked was each state society could apply for a $1,000 grant, and then each chapter could apply for a $500 grant. So adding that up in North Dakota, we had a good start there. And then it occurred to me that if we had more chapters involved, we would get more money.
Therefore, the Canadians.
Therefore, I contacted National to say, does this work for the Canadians too? And they said, of course. And so then I contacted the four Canadian chapters and said, we'd like to do this. We'd like you to apply for this grant. And they were all willing to do that. And so we came up with a considerable fund, which pays for the marker, the rock, the installation, and the event. And so, you know, the refreshments and various other things that we will have. I believe we're having a bagpiper come and play.
Yes.
One of the Native American tribes is providing color guard. So we are really looking forward to having, you know, a total involvement as far as this goes.
Enjoying my conversation with Helen Hatton and Sandy Sidler. Helen is with the Upper Canada DAR, and Sandy is the North Dakota State Chair of the DAR's America 250 Committee. We're talking about September 12th's dedication of our marker at the International Peace Garden from the DAR. Sandy and Helen both, maybe Sandy, you can take this first. Is the DAR a dynamic organization? In other words, do you continue to attract and recruit, if you will, new people?
Absolutely. We're always looking for new members. If you go to the website, dar.org, you can go on that site and click on a join button and get more information on membership. If you know you have a patriot in your family and you can prove it, you can put your information in there and you'll be contacted by some state society, whatever state you live in or want to join in. Also, if you know that you have someone in your family who used to be a member or is a member of DAR, it's very easy to connect to that person. For example, we just had a member, a prospective member saying, well, my grandmother was a member. And so all we have to do is connect back to her grandmother and get those documents. It does require documents and proof. You cannot just tell me I have a tree on Ancestry that says I have a patriot. It doesn't work that way. We have to have the proof that traces back with birth certificates, death certificates, wills, any other document, land documents, lots of
documents. Is that hard to prove?
It depends. It depends on your family and whether they kept records and lived in locations that had good record keeping. If they lived in the, you know, when they first were living probably in the New England area, there are very good records in that area. If they lived in the South colonies, sometimes not as good records. Generally the problem we have with most people is the middle generations. The 5, 6, 7 generations, the oldest generations, there's a lot of records of people who, you know, served in the Revolutionary War in a military capacity. There are muster lists and rolls that list those people by name and location. And then there's the lists, you know, the current information, your birth certificate, your parents, your grandparents. Most people know all of those people. Maybe even your great grandparents, you know. It's the people in between those two that were the ones that were moving from the east to the west that didn't have good records. And so that's where you have the most problem, is to find those people.
Tell me how each of you discovered the DAR. Helen, you first.
I got recruited by my aunt, and I refused it for years. Finally, I moved to New York City from Tampa, where I grew up. And I discovered I was recruited by the local DARs in New York City, and it was fabulous. I decided, well, this is pretty good because the networking was terrific. The social side was excellent, and it was in New York City. I had a built-in group of people that were really interesting into history and the whole thing. And I've been a member since 1976 and forever. It's really great because wherever you go, there are DARs. And we get requests in Canada, you know, I'm coming to Canada, what do we do? And the nice thing about the quaintly named units overseas is that because we are an odd group in a way that is offshore and not always able to look up stuff, et cetera, we have our own genealogists who will do it for us. And so they're very anxious to recruit. They are also actively recruiting other groups who participated in the Revolutionary War, which includes indigenous people of color. The Spanish have a whole tribe of them. And the French, you'll love this, the Parisian chapter is 90% related to Lafayette. So they're out there. You just need to find somebody who can help you do it. And we are ready to welcome you. It's a great group. And it's all over the world.
Sandy, how did you become a DAR?
Well, we had, you know, family stories in our family. My mother was from Southern Illinois, and very Southern Illinois. And so there was always the story that one of her ancestors was a baggage master with George Washington. Well, you know, that was the story. And of course, you know, as I got older and started to look into it, I found out that, yes, that's probably what he did. However, George Washington had a lot of baggage masters, and that didn't mean anything, really. However, there is local history in that area that said that when Lafayette came back on his return tour in 1825, this gentleman was still alive, and he went to the event, and Lafayette recognized him, and so the story is there. I didn't do anything about it for many years. I did genealogy a lot, but I didn't do anything about joining the DAR until I actually moved to Fargo. And then it took a few years. I went to a history genealogy workshop, and they had a table set up, the DAR did, and they said, so I went over and I said, you know, I know I have this patriot. And they said, okay, well, let's work on that. And so they worked on it. And they actually, the patriot that I went in under was somebody totally different on my father's side that I didn't know anything about.
And they helped you find that.
Yes, they did it. They did all the work for me. I didn't have to do anything.
And so I'm guessing someone who is interested who may not know, it's why not ask?
Exactly. And we get that quite a bit. You know, just recently when we were doing this exhibit at the public library, the children's librarian that we were working with, she said, oh, well, my grandmother was a member, but I've never done anything. Well, now she's going to be a member because we said, hey, you know, do it. It's really a benefit to your family and to your family's history to know these things and to continue them, to continue that legacy.
I find it interesting that my Revolutionary War ancestor, and Sandy, mine was a heck of a lot easier. Here are the papers. Bang. They couldn't wait to get me in. But my ancestor's name is also Hatton.
That's very unusual that you can go straight
in. It is. There are a handful of us who happen to have all gone through that male lineage. Now I have to start on my mother's side.
I actually have done several supplementals, which are additional patriots. And I have them on both sides now, both my mother's side and my father's side.
You know, though, the other thing about the Peace Garden that I find, this is just jumping back to why, it's location, location, location. And when you look at it, it is smack in the middle of the continental U.S. and it's right underneath Manitoba. Mm-hmm. Just to remind you of what's up there. But it's right in the middle. That in itself, I think, is symbolic.
We should emphasize that you're all hopeful that not just local members or even Canadian members of the DAR come, but anyone can come.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's open to the public. We actually have, I think they're connected with the DAR in Canada, but they live in Maryland, I believe. And there's the grandmother, the granddaughter, or the daughter and the granddaughter, the three of them are coming from Maryland. They have an ulterior motive because they want to go to the Peace Garden. But they're coming, and so we have other people that are coming that are not North Dakota or Canadian members.
But the other thing, too, is come see North Dakota. There's a lot up here that you just, people were scratching their heads and going, where?
Here.
It's under Manitoba. They don't know where that is either.
Let me ask each of you, as we kind of wind our conversation down today, when folks look at this marker 10, 30, 50 years from now, Helen, you can go first. What do you hope they think about?
Where we've all come from and where we have possibilities to go.
Sandy, how about you?
Yeah, I think what she says, where we come from as individuals. And this was one of the things about that traveling exhibit that I mentioned earlier. It's not the famous people. It's not the George Washingtons and the John Adams. They're, you know, we know about them, but we don't know about the Ichabod Marshalls and the Thomas Dagleys and some of those people who participated and why they participated and how they chose. This was a civil war, the Revolutionary War. This was brother against brother, community against community. It was very hard to make this decision. You know, would you support the king or would you break away from the king and become what's called treasonous because you were going against the king? You know, what was your choice and why? And so I think that's what we need to see when we look at these patriots.
Sandy, before we go, are there multiple organizations in North Dakota that people can inquire to?
Actually, we have four chapters in North Dakota, one in Bismarck and one in Minot, one in Devil's Lake, and then the one in Fargo. So we have four chapters here.
The America 250 marker dedication will take place Saturday, September 12th at around noon Central Daylight Time at the International Peace Garden in northern North Dakota. The ceremony will be followed by an opportunity to gather and visit. My guests have been Helen Hatton of the Upper Canada DAR and Sandy Sidler, North Dakota State Chair of the DAR's America 250 Committee. Helen and Sandy, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing the story behind the international celebration.
It was great. Thank you very much.
Still ahead on this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public, a preview of the North Dakota Book and Arts Festival, which is a free day-long celebration bringing local and regional writers, artists, and audiences together September 26th at the University of Jamestown. That's still ahead on Main Street. We are glad that you are with us. It follows this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Books and art often are ways to see the world through someone else's eyes, and a festival in its second year now in Jamestown is bringing those creative voices together in one place. The North Dakota Books and Arts Festival returns Saturday, September 26th at the University of Jamestown's Harold Newman Arena. The free day-long event gives local and regional writers and artists an opportunity to display and sell their work, meet the public and connect with other creators, and visitors can also attend free workshops and celebrate the release of the University of Jamestown's literary journal, Plain Song. With us today are Sammy Jo Wallace, she's an author and also co-founder of the event, Laura Pfau, she's an author and a co-organizer of the festival, Jill Pfaff, she's an assistant director in the James River Library System and co-founder of this event, and Aaron Cloyd, English professor and at the University of Jamestown and a co-founder of the festival. To all of you, welcome. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
It's good that you're here with us all today. Sammy Jo, let me start with you. For someone discovering the North Dakota Book and Arts Festival for the first time, what kind of experience can they expect?
They can expect to see a lot of authors, artists selling their books, a lot of local talent. So these are mostly regional writers. So Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota. We're going to have the North Dakota Poet Laureate North Dakota Poet Laureate there. We've got the State Troubadour and then Ramona Klein coming as well. And they're all amazing. And it's going to be such a cool event with all these different people.
What's the history, Aaron? This is the second year. Why was this created and why has it now evolved in Jamestown?
So I was first approached here at the university by Sammy Joe as a local author and by Jill. And they were actually looking to expand on something that they had put together a few years ago at the library. But it was so popular that they needed a new space. We should also note that we are inheriting this event somewhat from the fine folks in Ellendale, who used to organize a North Dakota Book Festival. But COVID had its way with that event, as many events. And so this has run for a number of years in different spaces, but we were given the blessing to pick up and to rebrand it as both a book and arts festival, and working somewhat in conjunction with the NDSU and the publishing group there. It's been a wonderful experience to be able to collaborate across multiple places and multiple backgrounds.
Jill, why is it important to bring writers and visual artists together? Why is it important that those creative communities are in Jamestown?
Well, first of all, Jamestown is centrally located in North Dakota, so we thought this was a great spot. We also want to celebrate our regional and local authors and let everybody know that we have some amazing talent in North Dakota and in the area. And it's great for the authors and artists to be able to network and see all the amazing things that we have to offer.
Laura, what's your role in helping organize a festival like this? Give us kind of the backroom process of how this all works.
Well, sometimes it kind of depends on the day. Yesterday I was mailing some flyers to actually the University of Mary so that they could share it with their students if they wanted to, so we can expand the community. Sometimes it's sending emails to people, just getting word out on the street too. I've contacted some artists that I know, because we always try to get artists as well as writers. And then if Jill tells me to do something, then I do it.
Sammy Joe, if someone is interested in still coming, are you full? Or is there room to have other folks still participate?
So our vendor booths, our artist booths, and our writers booths are all full. We actually filled them really quickly this year, and we've got over 80 people attending. However, if they are wanting to get on our cancellation list, those last minute cancellations do happen. We have a website through the library, and they can definitely fill out the application, and we call those in a first come, first serve order.
What do the artists and the authors tell you about why they want to be there? What is it that they want to do other than just sell books?
They want to meet their community. I think a lot of times, especially when you're a writer or an artist, you're doing a lot of this stuff by yourself. And then you're trying to get out there and meet people, and it's hard. The places that you have available to you are like Comic-Cons or craft fairs, and those aren't necessarily the right place for you to be. It's just a place you can be. And so this is a great place for them to meet other writers, to meet people who are actually interested in what they're doing, which, I mean, you would think in this age of social media and stuff would be easier to do, but it's actually quite difficult.
The festival also includes free workshops. First, how are they organized and what can attendees expect to see when they participate in a workshop?
So our schedule of events, it's going to start at 11 a.m. We will have Dr. Ramona Klein, and she's going to be talking about her upcoming book. Her presentation is called Teaching Heart, My Life from Native American Boarding School to Leader in Education. She has a very powerful presentation, which I've been able to witness in the past, so that'll be a great one. And then right after that, at 1 p.m., we'll have the Plain Song launch, which is University of Jamestown's literary journal. Aaron will speak more to you about that if you'd like. And then at 2 p.m., Dr. Denise Lajmadier, she's going to do a poetry reading and discussion, and she's also our North Dakota Poet Laureate. And then to wrap everything up at 3:30 p.m., singer-songwriter Chuck Suki, who is also the North Dakota State Troubadour. He'll be there giving a presentation. And yeah, so it's going to be a fun time.
Erin, in your role as a professor at the University of Jamestown, how do you hope this event encourages people? And I'm really thinking about young people to try maybe to be creative themselves, perhaps for the first time.
I think a whole lot of us have creative aspirations inside of us, but we don't always know what to do with them. And we don't always know who might want to hear those voices that need to speak on the page. And so what I'm hoping for both the university students and high school students, and I would say even middle school and elementary school students that are developing maybe a poem or maybe developing a story, that they could have a chance to come out and meet someone who has gone through that. And they have written that story, published that story. And so we really hope this is a place of encouragement, as Sammy Joe mentioned, a place of community, a place that says, keep writing, keep telling your story. The world needs to hear what you have to say.
I'm enjoying my conversation with Sammy Joe Wallace, Laura Pfau, Jill Pfaff, and Erin Cloyd. We're talking about the North Dakota Book and Arts Festival that returns to Jamestown on Saturday, September 26th at the University of Jamestown's Harold Newman Arena. It's free. It's free for anyone to attend, and it's also going to be packed. Erin, I want to stay with you for a moment, if I could. Jill mentioned this just a moment ago. This event coincides with the annual launch of the University of Jamestown's literary journal, Plain Song. Tell me more about the journal and its place in not only the celebration, but in the heart of the community of Jamestown?
So this year we will be launching our 39th issue. The magazine has been around since 1987. And in a world where everything is going digital, we're proud that we can still be able to print on paper and publish the magazine annually. It's long been available for university students and staff and faculty and alumni, but a few years ago, we really wanted to open it to the community. And so it's a place that anyone who is producing art and writing and thinking creatively can submit their work. And the deadline is the end of each calendar year. And so if an artist or an author is thinking about another place to submit, they're welcome to go to our website. If you just search the University of Jamestown Plain Song, you can find submission guidelines there.
Of course, the University of Jamestown and the James River Valley Library System have played an important role in organizing and supporting the festival. Jill, why is it important that the library hop in on organizing something like this that has region-wide really appeal?
Well, we love to support our authors and books, for sure.
What is the role of the library in helping organize?
We had a local author fair, which we wanted to celebrate our very local authors. It was just mostly Stutzman County and maybe reached out a little bit further. But mostly people from this area, if they are not living here. And so we wanted to make sure that people are aware of that we have some amazing talent here. And I think it's important that we promote those authors.
Sammy Jo, you mentioned earlier you're an author. Tell me your genre and what have you written?
I am. So I write in fantasy mostly. I have a young adult book out called Abney Kelly and the Yuletide Shenanigans. I have an adult cozy fantasy out called The Haunt. I recently released a book actually with Laurel, and it's a collection of stories that we did with our Wednesday writers group. And then I have a children's book actually coming out on September 8th.
That's coming right up here. I'm guessing you will have that available for folks at the festival.
I will.
Laurel, what else have you written?
So I have written a novel and called Past Darkness. It's contemporary fiction. And then I have a couple of collaboration books, mostly stories, although I did have a few poems in a book with another writing group in Jamestown. And then the one Sammy Joe mentioned is the newest one. Between six of us, we ended up with 50 stories. And that was a really fun collaboration because it got a little chaotic at times, very entertaining. But it was a lot of fun. And that book will also be available at the festival. And the title is titles come later.
I feel like my job is to encourage new authors who may not even know that that's a possibility. And so I spend a lot of my year reading student writing, and I have an opportunity to hopefully encourage those voices. And
let me ask each of you, because the topic comes up all the time and we're spending more and more time talking about it. You might even be able to guess what I'm going to ask you next. How is AI influencing writers? And what is your perception of how it may alter what we read, what I get to read in years to come? Aaron, do you want to take that first?
I think that the skills that writing and thinking on the page are going to become even more important in the coming years. And so if someone has the ability to think in sentence form and think in paragraph form, and to not only think in that way, but recognize what makes for solid communication, those skills are going to become more and more important in the coming years, as more and more folks, I think, unfortunately, decide to offload that to something else. And so I'm encouraged that folks like English professors and authors have a chance to stand up and say, our skills are more important than ever before. And together, let's make sure that those voices don't get lost.
Sam and Joe, what have you thought about AI and what you do as an author?
Well, I think it definitely has a huge effect on the community. And I mean, there's a big backlash, obviously, in our community over it. I think the scariest part is kind of the witch hunt going on with it, where, you know, people are being accused right and left. And I'm not a big supporter of that, but I do think people should be writing their own stuff. And I'm not really a big fan of, you know, people putting AI books out there and stuff, because then, I mean, how can you call yourself an author if you're not actually writing it, you know? And I mean, it's similar to the way I kind of feel about ghostwriters. I think it's fine to be a ghostwriter and, you know, be anonymous, but I don't think that the people that you're ghostwriting for should get to claim the title of author either.
Laurel or Jill, do you have any thoughts about AI and its use with writers?
I am deeply dismayed with people using AI for writing. They've done studies already that show that students who use it, well, actually anyone who uses it, the more you use it, essentially, the less intelligent you become, because you're not using your own thought processes. You're making it easy for yourself, and therefore you're losing the ability to think the way you should, like think on your feet. Like Aaron said, put things on the page and learn how to write it out. On top of that, there are studies that show that even reading on a screen can be distancing. Like you don't get the same depth out of something if you read it on a screen versus on the page, like a physical page. Now, I'm not against e-readers or anything like that. I'm just saying that if you really want to connect with the text, if you really want to read deeply into it and have a more of a effect on you, then a physical page is the best way to go. And if people are putting stuff out there that they didn't write, that they had a computer write for them, it's a travesty, in my opinion. So I'm very much that writing is hard work and you should have to do it, and don't have the computer do it for you.
Admission is free and participating writers and artists aren't charged vendor fees. Why is keeping the festival accessible such an important part of your mission?
Well, from a library standpoint, I would say we actually, all of our programs are free. We try not to charge anyone for anything because we want to make sure that it's, you know, accessible to our entire community for those that may not be able to afford it. And so we want to make sure that it's just really important to us that we have it free for everyone. And that's including the vendors. We do not charge vendor fees. We want to make sure that they're able to be a part of it.
I'm going to go around the room. Sam and Joe, I'm going to start with you. What are you most looking forward to about this festival?
Oh my goodness. I think as an introvert, I'm most looking forward to the break afterwards because we've been so busy. But I love getting to meet all the different authors because these are people, you know, that I mostly, I do our social media and stuff. So I see their videos and all these things beforehand. So it's so neat to actually get to actually, you know, see them in person. And you know, meet these people that I've been making videos about for months.
Aaron, how about you?
I think I'm looking forward to witnessing an arena full of individuals who are passionate about reading and about writing. And I think a whole lot of us, as Sammy Jo mentioned, tend to be introverted. And so for a few moments on a Saturday, we get to get together and then scurry back and sort of re-energize ourselves in another book. But we have a few moments to be together.
On a similar line, I'm looking forward to just seeing all of the people. But it's also really gratifying when you see like young people walking around carrying a book that they just bought from someone, or maybe a parent or grandparent bought it from them for them. That's just a really nice thing to see, especially when you know you hear a lot of people saying, well, nobody reads anymore anyway. But there are a lot of people that show up because they're excited to meet a certain writer. They want to get their autograph. They want to buy their book and have them sign it, etc. And then also just seeing some of the art that we have from local people and those different types of things that are going to be there.
I love people, so I love to see everyone there. And I'm the least introverted out of everyone here. I'm in my element when I see everyone excited, like Laurel said, excited to be there and excited to meet their authors, their favorite authors and things like that. So yeah, I'm just looking forward to seeing everybody, all the happy faces.
Best book I've read this year is...
Oh, goodness.
Who wants to pop out?
I will say Theo of Golden.
I've heard that recommended.
Theo of Golden is good. Probably the best one I read recently is called Hallowed Ground by James McPherson. And it's just a short little book. The subtitle is A Walk at Gettysburg. So he's basically just walking through Gettysburg, going through the monuments, major pivotal things that happened. Interesting note, James McPherson's probably the best living Civil War historian, and he was born in Valley City.
Can I sound like a nerdy English professor and say Moby Dick?
You can.
Hey. Yeah.
Spent the summer to read Moby Dick. It was amazing.
Well done. Well done. Sammy Jo?
Mine is probably, and I'm trying to think of the title, I think it's Murder in the Cathedral, and it is the last book written by Carrie Greenwood, who passed away earlier this year. She wrote the Phryne Fisher series, which I'm a huge fan of. It's a cozy mystery, and I mean, I think there's 1920 of these books. I have them all, and so it was, you know, kind of bittersweet to get to read that. I was, you know, especially being a fan for years.
The North Dakota Book and Arts Festival takes place from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday, September 26th. Get it on your calendar. It's worth a visit at the beautiful, I'll say, Harold Newman Arena on the University of Jamestown campus. Admission and workshops are free. It's an event that is open to all ages, certainly family friendly. For more information, you can look at on the James River Valley Library System's webpage. To all of you, to Sammy Jo Wallace, Laura Pfau, Jill Pfaff, and Aaron Coy, thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street, and best wishes with the festival.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. An American dipper calls across a rushing mountain stream. It's a rotund little bird with a stone-gray body that bobs rhythmically up and down, as if mounted on springs. But its feet are firmly planted on rocks just beneath the rolling water. Why do dippers dip? Let's consider three theories. Theory one. The dipping motion sort of camouflages the dipper against the turbulent water, making it harder for predators to spot it. Theory 2. Dipping helps the dipper see prey beneath the surface of the water. Or Theory 3, which might be the most likely. Dipping as well as the rhythmic flicking of the dipper's flashy white eyelids, may be a way of using body language to communicate, since rushing rivers can be so noisy they drown out bird calls. So, if one day, as you muse by a mountain stream, you spot an American dipper bobbing and winking in your direction, don't take it personally. It's probably beckoning to another dipper upstream. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 24th. On this date, in 1916, citizens of Fargo were reading about an attempted escape from the Cass County Jail. According to the local papers, only the eternal vigilance of Sheriff John Ross and his force of deputies prevented the escape from happening. During a routine sweep of the jail cells that occurred every Sunday, officers discovered homemade master keys for the jail. The keys were creatively assembled by a master hand, according to the Fargo Forum. They were made out of metal tablespoons that were flattened and shaped using heat from a flame fueled by collected grease from meals. The tools used included a safety razor blade and some spring steel. The report appeared in the Grand Forks Herald, which reported that the keys opened all the jail doors except one. The amateur metalworker had used a cardboard pattern that had been supplied to him. The keys were hidden in the jacket of Halston Wing, one of the prisoners. Halston had tried to escape a month earlier. However, police weren't convinced he was fully involved in this scheme, or even involved at all. They believed it was the work of J.E. Shannon, who was recently arrested. Shannon was being held in the jail, awaiting trial for the charge of attempted burglary at a Fargo drugstore. Since his arrest, he had almost escaped another time, and he was considered the only man in the jail who was both willing to make the attempt and have the skills to craft keys. J.E. Shannon had many aliases, but it was believed his true name was John Salmon, and his escapades had taken him all around the country. His acts mainly included burglary and pickpocketing, but also arson and drug possession. Shannon, or Salmon, pleaded guilty to his crime in Fargo and was sent to the prison in Bismarck. He left quite an impression on his jailers, who considered him one of the smoothest crooks that ever graced the Cass County Jail. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
The new U.S. effort to put economic pressure on Iran would also involve Iran's biggest trading partner, China.
And the question is whether the United States will pick a major fight with China over these Iran sanctions.
How is an economic D-Day supposed to work? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, President Trump's recent tariffs have renewed tensions between the United States and Canada, two nations linked by deep economic, political, cultural ties, and of course, our northern border. Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, Professor of History and Loman Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University, examines the potential consequences of the tariffs and places today's disputes within the broader history of U.S.-Canada relations. That's ahead tomorrow, right here on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.